I know it's been a couple of weeks since we've been in Daniel, and I know that when we covered the first part of chapter 11, there was a whole whirlwind of names. It was kind of like this soap opera drama that unfolded before us, and it was more twisted and convoluted than The Young and the Restless. So I understand that. So at any rate, as a public service, I have put together this slide that shows the timeline of all the southern kings of Egypt, the Seleucids, and the Ptolemies, and all the northern kings of Syria, the Seleucids. And there's also a handout most of you may have gotten. So that way you can all be prepared for the test. Okay, not going to have any excuses, even for those that are historically challenged. You got all the information you need for this, and you can see them all in one shot. When the test comes, you'll be ready. And if you look at the second to the last dude on the right-hand side of the northern kingdom of Syria, he was a guy by the name of Seleucus Philippeter, and he was being heavily taxed by Rome. And he had heard, we kind of touched on this last time, but he had heard that there was a lot of riches down in the temple of Jerusalem, and so he sent his agent Heliodorus down there to find out. And he did, and there's a passage in 2 Maccabees that says that there was this angelic intervention that kind of brought Heliodorus to his knees. Not real sure how much that took with him, though, because he went back to Damascus and ended up killing his boss. He assassinated Seleucus Philippeter. And his son, who would have been the heir to the throne, was actually being held hostage in Rome. And so during that vacancy, his brother, Antiochus IV, came in and took the throne. And that's where we left off last week, and that's where we pick up with verse 21, where it says, "And in Seleucus Philippeter's place shall arise a vile person," and that's Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, "to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue." And so, you know, all of these guys, the Ptolemaic kings and the Seleucid kings, whenever they would come to the throne, rather than just have numbers after their name, they all chose some sort of a regal name. This is the name that they would go by as king. And the name that Antiochus IV chose for himself was Epiphanes, which means God manifested. And he was actually the first one of the Syrian kings to kind of take that sort of, you know, I may not be the God, but I think I am a God, you know, and he kind of printed that on his coinage and so forth. And the Jews, because of the way he treated them, the Jews liked to change just one letter in his name from Epiphanes to Epimenes, and it changed it from God manifested to madman. And so that was the nickname that they gave him, of course, when his back was turned. Now, this cat is going to be very much a type of the Antichrist. Okay, that's why I think it's important for us to know about him. And if it weren't for Jesus and John and Paul, what they tell us about the Antichrist as it still being yet future when the New Testament was written, we would think that this guy fits the bill. He's that close of being a type of the Antichrist. And it says he comes in by intrigue, and that word literally means slippery. And he did a lot of schmoozing with the dignitaries around in the other kingdoms around him. You know, he kind of did a lot of backroom deals to kind of grease their palms so that they would support him in his claim to the throne. And then anybody within the kingdom that stood in his way, like, for example, say, his brother, he just killed him. And so he came in and took over that way. "And with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant." This is probably, the Prince of the Covenant is a reference to a guy by the name of Onias III, and he was the high priest at this time in Jerusalem. And he was a pretty godly man. He stood for the Torah and being biblical and being righteous, and he stood against this very heavy Greek influence that was coming from the Syrian kingdom, the Seleucid dynasty. Remember, they were the offspring of Alexander the Great, as it were, and they were trying to change all of the world into Greeks. And there were a lot of Jews who supported that. And there was a guy by the name of Onias that stood against that. And so his brother, actually, who took a Hellenistic name, Jason, and he worked to have him, he bribed Antiochus to make him the high priest. And it appears as though he may have, at least he was involved in the assassination of Onias. And so it says that he stood before him, but he was broken as well. And then after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. For he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, the spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, which would be Egypt, with a great army. And the king of the south shall also be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him, and his army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. So this is talking about when Antiochus from Syria will go down and do battle with Ptolemy in Egypt and whoop him. And so many will fall down slain. But both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. So after this, they're going to come together and have this kind of a powwow and, trying to work out some sort of a peace treaty kind of negotiation. And they're both just telling the other one what they want to hear and not really having any intentions on following through with it. And they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper. And at the end, it will still be at the appointed time. And while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, and he will do damage and return to his own land. And we'll explain that in a second. And at the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. So he goes back up to Syria. He's kind of thinking, you know what, I should have finished the deal down there. I could make Egypt a province of Syria. And so he's on his way back down there to kind of finish it up. But it says, ships from Cyprus shall come against him, and therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So as Antiochus was on his way back down to Egypt to do battle again with Ptolemy, he got as far as like 4 or 5 miles outside of Alexandria, which is on the western side of the land of Goshen, the Delta area. And he gets within 4 miles of Alexander, and there was this guy, this Roman dignitary. He was dispatched by the Roman Senate with a letter that was addressed to Antiochus, and it was basically a cease and desist order. And so he hands it to him, and he says, the Senate awaits your answer. And when it says that it came from Cyprus, the word in the Old King James says Kittim, and that may be, I mean, that's literally what the word is. That's a good translation of it, a transliteration of it. And it did mean that island of Crete or Cyprus. I mean, it does refer to that island, but it also refers to like lands west. And so it may be talking about Cyprus as a place of where a Roman port may have been, and this is where this guy from Rome came from. Or it could be just simply, in fact, in the Septuagint of the Old King James, in the Greek translation of the Hebrew, it's the word that means Romans, Romeo. And so it's, he came from the land of the Romans. And so Antiochus says to him, when Linnaeus gives him this tablet letter, and he says, the senator awaits your answer, and he says, well, let me get with my crew and I'll get back with you, we'll discuss this and I'll let you know. And so Linnaeus took his stick, cane or walking stick or whatever it was, and he drew this circle around Antiochus in the sand, and he says to him, you can take all the time you want, but before you step outside of this circle, I will have my answer. And so Antiochus just kind of goes, okay, well, then we'll go back. We'll accept, we will bow to Rome. He didn't want to have a war with Rome. And so he relented, but last part of verse 30 says, so he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So he's going to go back, and on his way back to Syria, of course, he has to go by Jerusalem, and there's this large contingent of Hellenistic Jews in the area that are trying to basically stop all of the old ways. They don't want to worship Yahweh. They want to worship Zeus. They want to turn the temple in Jerusalem into a pagan temple. And they all had Greek haircuts and wore togas and changed their names and things like that. And he says he shows favor to those guys. And by the time he got back to Jerusalem, he took the embarrassment that Linnaeus and Rome had given him in stopping him outside of Alexandria. He took that shame that he was feeling from that. He took it out on the Jews, and he slew tens of thousands of them. And put tens of thousands of them into captivity. I mean, he just really put a big hurting on the entire land. And it says, forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. And then they shall take away the daily sacrifice and place there the abomination of desolation. If you've been with us, you remember that's something that was given in the vision that Daniel had in chapter 9. Where he talks about this future guy who will make a peace treaty with Israel for 1 week, 1 7-year period. And then at some point he's going to bring about the abomination of desolation. And we learned back in chapter 9 that this date that is being prophesied here in chapter 11 is actually December 16th, AD 167. And that's the day that Antiochus says to them, you can no longer worship Yahweh in this temple. He erected an image of Zeus and put that in the Holy of Holies and demanded that they worship Zeus. And then to seal the deal, he took a pig. Now, understand, this is Jerusalem. This is in the Jewish temple. He took a pig and offered it as a sacrifice on the altar, and then poured the fat that came from the offering. He poured that out as a libation before this image of Zeus. Of course, that was the straw for many of the devout Jews. And it says, then those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So there was a priest by the name of Mattathias, and he had five sons. Primarily, the number one son was a guy by the name of Judas Maccabeus. And he led a revolt. And of course, they were a very small kind of militia type of force against this great Syrian empire. And so they couldn't beat them in one-to-one battles, so they just kind of conducted this thing of guerrilla warfare for a couple of years and actually defeated Antiochus. And you've heard of the Maccabean Revolt. There is, if you're familiar with the Catholic Bible or the Apocrypha, that they have a couple of books called First and Second Maccabees, and it kind of gives the history of this. They're not inspired scriptures or anything like that, but they're historical works that have a certain amount of veracity to them, and that's how we can learn about this. The revolts are, this was on December 16th, and early in 166, this revolt started, and within a couple years they had defeated the Syrians. And those who were of those who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame and by captivity and plundering. And now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, and many will join with them by intrigue. And some of those who of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white, until at the end of time, because it shall stand, it shall be for the appointed time. Now, this is verse 35. From verse 1, we did the first 20 verses last time. From verse 1 of chapter 11 through verse 35, the Bible guys have counted 135 fulfilled prophecies in those 35 verses. Wrap your brain around that for a minute. Just let that sink in. This is why this passage of Scripture is one of the primary reasons why the critics look at it and say it couldn't have been written by Daniel. It couldn't have been a prophecy that happened in the 5th century B.C. It had to be something that was done in the latter part of the 2nd century. It had to be done after the fact, and it was done to just kind of spur patriotism among the Jews against the rising threat of the Romans. That's what the critics say. But the evidence shows that it was written by a guy named Daniel in the 5th century B.C., and we have 135 very empirical prophecies that were fulfilled within these 35 verses. Now, between verse 35 and 36, we're going to see a transition between this guy Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes, who is a type of the Antichrist. And there's a transition between 34 and 35 where he's not talking about the Antichrist anymore, not talking about a type of the Antichrist anymore. He's actually talking about the Antichrist. And much of what happens in the latter part of the chapter wasn't fulfilled by Antiochus, and so there's still yet future. And as early as Jerome, the last part of the chapter was identified as Antichrist. So it's not some sort of recent thing that Bible guys have come up with. And verse 36 to the end of the book, chapter 13, 12, verse 13, is going to refer to the 280 years was in the first half of the chapter, and now the last half, and then chapter 12 is going to refer to this future 7-year period that we know as the tribulation. And that's kind of going to be the focus of the rest of our study tonight. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, we won't turn to it now. We'll look at it in a few minutes. But in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 13 to 18, we have the rapture of the church. As I said, we'll look at that passage in a few minutes. But then following the rapture of the church, there's going to be the 7-year period of judgment that we know as the tribulation. And this is given to us in Revelation chapter 6 all the way through chapter 18, as well as many other places in Scripture. But that's kind of where it's laid out semi-chronologically anyway. And that's going to be followed by the judgment of the nations, or what's also called the judgment of the sheep and the goats, that we see in Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 to 46, where Jesus separates the sheep from the goats, and it was the, inasmuch as you've done it to the least of these, you've done it unto me, and inasmuch as you didn't do it, you didn't do it to me. That judgment will take place at the end of the tribulation, where he separates the survivors of the tribulation that supported Israel and those that didn't. That's really what it boils down to. And then that's going to be followed by a 1,000-year period that we know as the millennium. It's given to us in the first 6 verses of chapter 20 of Revelation. And then at the end of the millennium, because during this time Satan is bound and cast in the bottomless pit, and there's this utopian society. Okay, there's this, most of the effects of the curse will be lifted. And the people that survived the tribulation will begin repopulating the earth under this perfect, almost Edenic culture, with Jesus ruling with an iron rod. He'll be physically ruling from Jerusalem. And this will go on for 1,000 years, proving that even if somebody lives in a perfect environment, they still have a sin nature. And as soon as they have the opportunity to act on it, they will. Because at the end of the 1,000 years, Satan is going to be released from the bottomless pit, and he will go throughout the earth mustering armies to fight against Jesus, and they'll be destroyed by fire from heaven that will come down and kill them all. And the Antichrist and the false prophet and Satan and all the bad guys are all going to end up in the lake of fire at the end of the millennium. And then there will be the new heaven and the new earth. All of that up to the new heaven, new earth is covered in these, in this overview in the last chapter and a half. And the king, verse 36, shall do according to his own will. So this is not Antiochus the Fourth. This is this guy that he foreshadows. This guy that's going to take his place, if you will. We don't know who he is. I personally think he's more than likely alive somewhere. But we don't know who he is. But he's going to do according to his own will. And he shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. It's going to happen just exactly the way the Bible prophesies that it will happen. Even though he's going to be doing according to his own will, he's going to be following God's plan exactly in his rebellion. Isaiah chapter 14 gives us a little insight into the fall of Satan. In verses 13 and 14 of Isaiah 14 says, talking about Satan, Lucifer, "For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. and I will be like the Most High. Five times in these two verses, Satan says, I will. I will, I will, I will, I will. And he didn't. You know, he willed, but he couldn't do it because God cast him out. But that's still in his desire. And so since he can't do it himself, he's going to try to, and you know, you fathers kind of know how you try to live vicariously through your sons. Well, that's what Satan's going to try to do through this guy. He's going to actually, he's not, the Antichrist will not be demon possessed. He will be Satan possessed. And Satan himself will come inside of this guy to equip him and to empower him to do this final rebellion. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 verses, or chapter 2 verses 3 and 4 says, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first. And you can make a case, we don't have time to do it tonight, but you can make a case that this falling away is actually a reference to the rapture. It's not talking about some sort of apostasy as if falling away from the church, but it's being snatched away from the earth would be an accurate translation of this. Don't know that that's what it's saying, but it's a possibility. But that day won't come until the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. This is the Antichrist, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And so Satan is going to try what he couldn't do in Isaiah 14, he's going to try to do through the Antichrist. And he says, he will regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all. Obviously, you know, when this guy doesn't have the desire of women, he's not one of most of today's politicians. You know, I don't think that would be one of them. But actually, some see this as a statement that he's going to be a homosexual because he's not going to have the desire of women. But it doesn't say that he's not going to have the desire for women. It says that he won't have the desire of women. And that may not mean anything, or it may mean something, because going back to Genesis chapter 3, where God prophesies that the Messiah is going to come through the seed of a woman, every descendant of Eve up until the time of Mary had in their hearts the hope that maybe they would be the woman that would bring the Messiah. And that was the desire of all women, to be the mother of the Messiah. And that was a phrase, the desire of women. If you said that in that day, you knew exactly what you meant. It was the desire that they would become somehow the one who would bring the Messiah into the world. And this guy isn't going to have the desire of women. For in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know, and he shall honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. And thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Divide the land for gain. Could you imagine somebody wanting to take the land of Israel and divide it? I mean, does that even make sense that somebody would actually want to do that, that there would be anybody that wanted to take the land of Israel and divide it up? here's the map of Israel today, okay? It's not a very big place. It could fit inside Oklahoma from top to bottom. And it's about as wide as El Reno to Shawnee at its widest point. So it's not a very big place at all. It's a very small place. And for the last 50 years, the Palestinians that live there in Israel, the Arabs that live in Israel, have been talking about what they call a two-state solution. You know, the problem with, we just need to divide Israel. We need to give us our part, and then we can make nice with each other. Well, if you look at the southern part of Israel, everything kind of south of the Dead Sea, that's a very barren, arid wasteland. I mean, there are some villages, there's some towns there, but it's not very inhabited at all. It's very, it's a really barren place. And so if you set that aside, and then they say, well, you know, what we want, just give us the West Bank. Now, we just want the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I mean, who would see that just, I mean, all they want is just a, you know, the West Bank would be on the western side of the Jordan River, and they just want a little strip right there along the shores of the Jordan, the banks of the Jordan River, and then a little strip over on the Mediterranean. That's all we want. Just, you know, just give us a little bit of land that's got some water, riverfront property. Well, here's the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That's when they say the West Bank, that's what they mean. And it's actually, I mean, if you take that, you're taking half of Israel away. We just set the desert aside. And so for 50 years, they haven't been able to do this because they want more than what the Jews in their right minds would want to give them. And so every kind of negotiation that they have has always failed. It's always been reneged on by the Palestinians. And it's almost like they're saying now there is no peace. There is no way they can ever come to a two-state solution. But this guy is going to do it. You know, this guy is going to come on the scene, and he's going to convince both sides that this is a good deal. Probably this is that seven-year peace treaty that we saw back in chapter 9. That's probably what he's going to accomplish. And it says at the end of the time, verse 40, the king of the south, is this talking about Egypt? I don't know, because the king of the north is not talking about Antiochus anymore. And so this could be, maybe it's Egypt, maybe it's a whole consortium of African nations. It could be, because the Antichrist has kind of risen to power and he's trying to control the whole world. And at this time, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through, and he shall enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But for those, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon, which is basically Jordan. That's talking about modern-day Jordan, which actually has a peace treaty with Israel. I mean, when you go to Israel, if you want to go to Jordan, you can. You can do an extension and actually pass back and forth on their borders. You can't go to other nations, Arab nations, and come back to Israel. But you can go to Jordan and come back to Israel because they have a peace treaty. And it's believed that when the Antichrist breaks this covenant in the middle of it and declares war on the Jews, that they will go to this place known as Petra in Jordan as a hideout. And you may be familiar with it from the Indiana Jones movie and Temple of Doom, and where he comes riding in on this horse, you know, and he's going through this crack in the cliffs. There's just this huge crack goes through the cliffs and opens up. You as you walk through this, it's called a seek, and as you go through this seek, it's maybe a half a mile long, something like that, just kind of winds through the mountain. And you come out on the other end, and it opens up into this big carved city that's carved out of the sides of this canyon. And the first thing you see is this thing that's called the treasury. And just to get a little bit of an idea how big this is a picture I took several years ago. That circle, those are people. So that'll give you somewhat of an idea how big this place is. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people could have lived in this place. It used to be a very thriving empire, kingdom. Until the Romans discovered how to stop their water source. And so the Jews, it's believed that maybe they will go and hide out from the Antichrist based upon some other prophecies like in Isaiah and so forth. But he says, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, and he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. So it's going to be, you know, and that's all about Africa that they knew of back in those days. And so who knows how far this would go. And news of the east and the north shall trouble him. So therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. Contrary to what many people think, the Antichrist will not rule the whole world. He wants to. And he's ruling a large segment of it. But he doesn't have the kings of the east under his control. Which, what's east of the Middle East? China. He doesn't have the kings of the north under his control. Which, what's north of Israel? Russia. He doesn't have those under his control. And so they come to this big battle. They're staging for this big battle and winner takes all kind of a thing. And they're assembling in this huge valley in the northern part of Israel known as the Valley of Megiddo. In the New Testament, it's called Armageddon. And they are staging for this big battle between these three huge armies. And you know, people talk about the Battle of Armageddon. I wonder if the Battle of Armageddon will take place. There's no place in the prophecy that says it will happen. It says that they are staged for war in the Valley of Megiddo. What I think happened is when, at the end of the tribulation, when these guys are the king of the north, king of the east, and the Antichrist are all getting ready to duke it out, Jesus comes back. But he comes back to Petra. And he first of all, he takes the Jews that have been held in captivity as they're hiding out. They're not really captives, but they're hiding out from the Antichrist. He gets them, and then they do this. It's about 7,500 miles to Israel from there to Jerusalem. And that's where he puts his foot. He's bringing Israel with him. It's prophesied in the ending verses of Revelation. And he puts his foot down on the Mount of Olives and causes this great valley, this big earthquake is going to happen, and it's going to split the Mount of Olives from the east to the west, and it's going to go across the Kidron Valley over to the Temple Mount. And it's then that the Antichrist is going to say to the king of the north and the king of the east, you know, why are we fighting each other? He's our real battle. He's our real enemy. Let's go beat him. And they'll say, yeah, let's go do that. And so they'll make this trip from Megiddo down to what Joel prophesies as the Valley of Jehoshaphat, which is an Old Testament name for the Valley of the Kidron Valley, which is, runs right between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives. And that's where it talks about the blood up to the horses' bridles and that sort of thing. I think that's where the actual battle will take place. And of course, it's not going to be no battle. Jesus is going to go like this and thump them all in the head and beat them all up. But he shall plant tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious land, the glorious holy mountain, and yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. And at that time, verse 1 of chapter 12 says that Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. This is, you know, people say that there is not going to be there's no future 7-year tribulation period, that it was all fulfilled in 70 AD, is what a lot of people try to say. What happened in the 40s to the Jews makes what happened to the Jews in 70 AD pale. You know, the Holocaust that happened under the Nazis is the worst thing that the Jews have ever undergone. And yet it says that there's going to be a time of trouble such as never been since there was a nation, even to that time. And so that's not the tribulation. The Holocaust wasn't the tribulation. Hitler wasn't the Antichrist. That wasn't the fulfillment of any kind of prophecy. So that is still yet future. This trouble that is worse than anything anybody's ever seen before hasn't happened yet. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. Now, some people say, you know, yeah, but Jesus said in the world you're going to have tribulation. That was promised by the Lord. And we all, you know, we're always having tribulation. And so, you know, you're just making a mountain out of a molehill here. Well, there's a difference between tribulation and the tribulation. Okay? A very, not quantitative, but qualitative difference between the two. Tribulation is relative. You know, my tribulation might be your chill. The tribulation is going to be very objective. I mean, people are going to go, oh, that's the tribulation. There's not going to be debate over that. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Now, I said we would read the passage in 1 Thessalonians 4, and let's look at it now, starting with verse 13. But I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. The thing was going around in Thessalonica in that time that if you died before the rapture happened, because they all thought Jesus was going to come back. You know, when they were standing on the hillside in Acts chapter 1 and Jesus ascended, they were all standing there waiting for him to come back. They just thought he was going to go up in the clouds and come back in the next second. And an angel had to say, no, you know, go on about your business. He'll come back when he's ready. And that was the prevailing thought throughout the first generation of the church. And so there was a teaching that was going around that if you died before the rapture happened, you were out of luck. And so Paul writes 1 Thessalonians to set that straight. And he says, I don't want you to sorrow as those who have no hope, like of those that have fallen asleep. For if we believe that Jesus died, verse 14, and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. For the Lord himself will descend with a shout, descend from heaven with a shout, and with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God. And the dead in Christ shall rise first. And then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. Now, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 is talking to the church, right? It's talking to the church during the church age, regarding the church age. Daniel chapter 12 is talking to Israel. Revelation chapter 20, let me show you what I mean here. In Revelation chapter 20, verses 4 and 5, it says, and the rest of the dead, this is talking about the period of the millennium, and it says, the rest of the dead shall not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. And this is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Now, I know this is a little, if this is uncharted territory for you, this can be a little dicey, but when it talks about the first resurrection, it began on the first Easter Sunday when Jesus rose. He was the first fruits of the resurrection, right? That's what Paul tells us. It began then, and we'll have another example of it at the rapture when the graves are opened up. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 was talking about the dead in Christ rising first. And so that will be a continuation of the first resurrection. And then we'll see the ending of the first resurrection is at the end of the millennium in Revelation chapter 20. You follow me? It's not an event. It's a series of events that we call the first resurrection. And so Daniel, of course, doesn't see this because he's looking at it as an Old Testament prophet, and he doesn't see the church age. The Old Testament prophets of the church was hidden from the Old Testament prophets. So he didn't see that. He didn't see this thousands of year gap between Jesus rising and the end of the millennium. He sees it as kind of a general event where you have this resurrection of the dead and the good guys go to heaven and the bad guys don't. They go to some other place. That's how Daniel was able to see it, because he was seeing it from a Jewish perspective, looking at it from the Old Testament economy. I hope that's not too overwhelming. But these two resurrections, the first resurrection and the last resurrection, or the second resurrection, are going to be separated by, 3,000 years, if you will. And those who are wise, verse 3, shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Many shall run to and fro. This has the idea of somebody running over here and then somebody running over here, and just the idea of everybody's busy and going and doing and accomplishing, and it kind of smacks of the industrial age and that whole thing where we just... Isaac Newton, the guy that apple fell on his head, he was not only a great scientist, but he was also a very godly man. And when he was reading this passage where he says, many shall run to and fro, and he just took it for what it said. He believed it's the word of God, and he just took it as that. And he thought, for the whole world, for everybody to be running to and fro and accomplishing all this sort of stuff, man's going to have to travel at least 50 miles an hour. And, by that time, they had steam engines that could go about half that. And he said, but they didn't have that in Newton's day, but that was all they had up until cars. And so he said, man's going to have to travel at least 50 miles an hour. And Voltaire, the great skeptic, the French skeptic, the guy that said the Bible was a bunch of hogwash, he said, what a fool you are. Everybody knows that if somebody was traveling that fast, your heart would stop. There's no way that man can travel 50 miles an hour, your heart would stop. Well, from the beginning of time up until 1948, if we took all of man's knowledge from the beginning of time to 1848, that would accomplish 1 inch on a timeline. From 1848 to 1948, whoops, I'm sorry, I went the wrong way. From 1848 to 1948 would be 3 inches. So in that next century, man's knowledge tripled over all the accumulation of knowledge from the beginning of time. From 1948 to 1988 would be the equivalent of over 650 feet. That was 1988. That was before the technological revolution. That was before the internet, and that was before, I mean, I've got more computer power right here than the computers that they had back in the 60s that took up whole buildings. And that's all come about in the last 30 years. Man's knowledge, it says that for knowledge shall increase. People are going to run to and fro. They're going to be going more than 50 miles an hour, and man's knowledge shall increase. You know, even just today, I talked to East Africa, Ukraine, and Israel. Can you imagine that? You know, that's a no thing. Nothing. But most likely, this is not talking about advances in technology and filling up encyclopedias. You younger people, ask an older person what an encyclopedia is. But this isn't talking about that, okay? It's probably talking about, because the subject is that of end times. And it's probably, you know, he says to Dan, he says, I want you to just seal up the book and set it away until the end of the time, because at the end of the time, man's knowledge is going to increase. I mean, it's possibly talking about all this technological stuff, maybe, but I think it's more likely talking about knowledge of the end times, knowledge of eschatology, knowledge of the last things. And if we think about how in the last two centuries, how much the fever for understanding end times, I mean, nobody read Revelation before the 1800s. You know, they looked at it and it was like, whew. Nobody read Daniel back then, tried to understand it. Nobody looked at prophecy because it was just a sealed book. But in the last, I mean, look at how much knowledge we have gained about end times in recent days. And I believe that we are living in the days of fulfilling prophecy, that we are in these days of the end times. As I said earlier, I believe I would be very surprised if the Antichrist is not alive today. But let me be quick to say that I don't base my eschatology upon the headlines. You know, even as I look at what's going on in the Middle East right now and I see that is fitting into prophecy, I hold on to that very loosely, because I don't try to look at the headlines and the geopolitics of the world today and try to connect the dots with prophecy, because the dots keep moving. You know, and what people were sure was a fulfillment of prophecy 20 years ago is kind of like, that's so last century, you know. And so I think that the danger of that is that it can kind of make people not care about prophecy. And that's the opposite of what I think the Lord's will is. So I believe we're living in the days of fulfilling prophecy. And it says, and I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others. So we're back to Daniel in this vision. You know, I mean, he just had this vision that the angel has been telling him all about. That's what all of this last chapter and a half has been about. And then Daniel looked, and he saw these two others that were there on the riverbank, and then there was the one on the other, on that riverbank, one on this and one on that. And then one said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river. We saw that at the beginning of chapter 11, you know, that some people think maybe Jesus, but most likely it was an angel like Gabriel or somebody like that. But he says to the other one, he says, well, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? You know, and I it was a setup kind of a thing. You know, I don't think that obviously these are angelic beings. And I don't think this one angel was saying, gosh, I wonder when this is going to happen. Oh, well, let me tell you, you know, I think it was probably for Daniel's benefit, you know, and kind of like, you know, two people go into a crowd one day and then say to your buddy, just say, did you know that Jesus died for your soul? No, well, tell me about it. You know, is that kind of a thing, you know? And so how long shall the fulfillment of these things go? And then I heard the man clothed in linen. This is the big angel that had the bronze and all of that we saw last time, who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand, he held up his right hand like he's going to swear on the Bible, but then he held up his left hand too. He's going to swear with both hands. And he says, he swore by him who lives forever, and it shall be for a time, a times, and half a time, which is Bibleese for 3.5 years. You got time, 1 year, times, which would be 2 years, and then a half a time, which would be 3.5 years. My 68-year fingers don't bend like that anymore. But it's going to be, the 7 years of the tribulation is oftentimes divided into two equal parts. And we saw it in chapter 9, where we talked about the week, this 1 week, the seven-year period, that in the middle of the week, the Antichrist is going to break the covenant. And it's oftentimes spoken of in as 3.5 years, or 42 months, or 1,260 days. And you got the first half of 1,260 days and the second half of 1,260. First half of 42, second half 42. With the Antichrist's abomination that makes desolation, that brings desolation, that's the dividing point between the two. Okay. And so he's saying that it's going to be 3.5 times before this has happened, 3.5 years. Although I heard it, I didn't understand. And so I said, "My Lord, what shall the end of shall be the end of these things?" And so he said, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the end of time. And many will be purified, made white, refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall." So when the time comes, the angel tells Daniel, you know, don't worry about it. You just go on, live your life, and you're going to, you know, you can just chill because God's got this under control. But the wicked aren't going to get it, but those that the righteous are. They'll get it when the time comes. And from that time, from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Oh, that's 1 month more than 3.5 years. There's 1,260 days in 3.5 years in the Jewish calendar, lunar calendar. Well, what's the 1,290 days? Where do you get this extra day? I don't know. Or extra month. Maybe it could be the sheep and the goats judgment that takes place at the end of the tribulation when Jesus comes back. Could be a reference to that. He's going to do, I mean, that's pretty good that he can do all that separation in 1 month. But he's Jesus, so I don't think that'll be a problem. Maybe that's it. We don't know. But those who are there then will know because we come back with him when he comes back. But he says, "Blessed is he who waits and comes to 1,335 days. Okay, now they just added another 45 days to it. You know, we go from 1,260 to 3,045. Where did this extra month and a half come from? I don't know. I mean, maybe they're taking a break for the NBA playoffs or something. I don't know what it is. It doesn't tell us. Some think that but nobody knows. "But go your way until the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days." You know, if he didn't tell Dan, why do we think he should tell us? I think, the important thing about this is that we know what we believe and why we believe it. If you haven't been able to tell from tonight, I believe very comfortably, I'm very, very safely rooted in the pre-trib, pre-millennial position. I don't see that as a prerequisite for anything, though. Within this book, there's a lot of parameters that God gives us. We can be wrong in a lot of ways. And you don't have to be right about end times. You can have your own views on that. And it's okay. But know why you believe that. You know, somebody says, "Well, I'm pre-wrath rapture." Okay, well, know why you believe that. Don't just do it because somebody told you or because you read a book or my church believes this. Well, what do you believe and why do you believe it? I think that's more important than having every T crossed and I dotted as far as eschatology goes. And I think this is a very important thing. Revelation is the only book in the Bible that says they're blessed on the person who reads it and heeds it will be blessed. It's the only book that promises that blessing. And yet it's the least read book in the whole Bible. It's the least one that people read and heed, and it's the only one that promises a blessing if you do. So I don't think this is, you know, people say, "Well, I just believe in pan-trib, whatever pans out." That's not what the Bible says. That's not what the Bible teaches. You know, if you want to have another view, that's okay, but have a view and have it being biblical. Have some Bible to base it on. Chuck and I were talking about this the other day. There's not any of them that don't have their problems. They all have kind of issues. The pre-trib position has some problems that are a little hard to kind of, well, what about this verse? Well, I'm not sure. But I think the overwhelming preponderance of Scripture supports the pre-trib, pre-millennial view. And the parts that I don't understand, I just figure, well, if when he shows it to me, I'll get it. But know what you know and why you know it. That's what's important. Okay? And if you don't know what to know, just come and tell me, or see me, and I'll tell you. Father, we come before you tonight, and we just thank you for this book. What an amazing thing that you did. Not only I'm blown away at the preservation that you've given it, and we have it here before us tonight, but just the prophecy that was given, how much of the prophetic word has been made sure through the words that you imparted to Daniel. And I just thank you for these few weeks that we've had to study it, and I pray that we would all go away with not only a deeper appreciation for the subject of prophecy, but an excitement for the days in which we live, because for such a time as this have you placed us where we are. And there's only so much time that we have. There's only so many days that are left for us to work. And so may we be about your business until you come. Yes, Jesus. And it's in your name that we ask it. Amen.